Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a responsive day for the 11th of Iyar. Today, I found a responsive of the Tzitz Eliezer from the 12th volume, 12th Chelek, the responsive number 59, which is dated Yud Aleph Iyar, 11th of Iyar, without a date, which is so exciting because Tzitz Eliezer is usually so good about giving the full date, not just the 11th of Iyar. So I've got other Meshivim who I use even though they only give parts of dates like Chaim David Alevi because I like their Tshuvot so much. Usually Tzitz Eliezer, not only do I like his Tshuvot so much, but I get a full date and year, but not in this case. So it's something new and different for us in our search for Tshuvot. I did not mention Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser in the OU until this point, so let's mention it here. Thank you to them for putting the shiurim up for us so that we can share some Torah with each other. The Tzitz Eliezer would ask the following question. It's from a Shochet Ubodik, the ritual slaughter, who's also a bit of a Talmud Chacham, and he asked him the following question. So I don't know, the year here would have kind of helped because of the medical advice that's being discussed in the responsum. I am not endorsing the medical advice. A couple of nights ago, I met a guy who came up to me and was very sweet and very nice and generous and thanking me for the shiurim, and he said something like, you know, and I love your shiurim, and he says, but you know, there was a tshuva that you reviewed about artificial insemination, and I remember the tshuva vaguely, and he said, but it's 30-year-old medicine and 30-year-old ideas. And I said, it's true, I just review the tshuvot that I get. And he says to me, you know, I think maybe you should put in a caveat or put in a thing saying this is what the tshuva wrote, but we wouldn't think of it these days today. So maybe I have been remiss sometimes in not noting those things. So here we're going to talk about the treatment of those with certain kinds of psychological or mental problems, and I want to say that I don't know the circumstances, so I don't know where they're getting the medical advice, and therefore it could be that they're going to be mentioned of things as if they were good medical ideas, that it might be that many of us today don't think of as good medical ideas of how to treat people with problems, especially psychological problems, and I am not weighing in on that. The questions that we're going to be focusing on are the Kibbut Av Va'Em questions. The underlying assumption of the question was, this man's mother, he's a Shochet Ubodik, which doesn't matter, just was in the tshuva and I remembered it. So he's got a job, he's a Talmid Chacham, he's a Torah concerned Jew. His mother, sadly, has lost her mind. It's not quite clear in the tshuva if she's lost her mind because of age or just because she's lost her mind. But in any case, she is living with him and his family, and she interrupts and she makes a scene and she does things that are ruining the shalom bayit, meaning she's in a state where she screams a lot for some reason. It's not clear in the response. She screams, she complains, she whatever it is she does is very disruptive. And the question is, can he tie her to a chair? Now I want to stress, and this is the piece, in the question it's kefi pegudat harofe. There's a doctor who says this is what you have to do for your mother in this situation. It reminds me, there's a movie I saw a long time ago called The Madness of King George III, where it seems like King George III, the madness is well known, but in the movie, they make it seem like what he had was something called porphyria, which is a disease that can lead to at least temporary bouts of insanity. But in any case, the treatment they had, because when he was having a bout, he would yell and scream or whatever, was they would tie him to a chair and they would put stuff over his mouth so that he couldn't, they would like a mask over his mouth, a muffle, so that he couldn't, it didn't stop him from breathing, but it stopped him from being able to scream, and he would have to wear it. Now, that was in the 1700s, so I'm not saying that we haven't moved on from there, and I don't know, again, the year of these things. So, and I don't know how we treat it could be that today we would medicate such a person, and therefore the question wouldn't come up, although it's worth saying that if we medicate somebody into basically a coma, it's unclear to me whether or not you could do that to a parent as well. We'll get to that in the tshuva. The man writing the question, therefore, is not asking for the medical question, and the sister is not going to question that medical advice. I'm not saying we have to accept that medical advice, but he's not going to question it. The question is he allowed to do this to his mother, even granted it's the right thing for her? Maybe a better example that's not in this tshuva, but an example that I thought of as I was rethinking this tshuva to present it to you today was, let's imagine another situation where a parent is physically infirm, such that they can't walk so well. And if they walk, there's even with, let's say, they can't walk well on their own, so they, I just saw somebody recently who was an elderly woman who was a teacher of mine many, many years ago, and she walks with a walker now. She says, I walk with a walker because my son said to me, you absolutely have to walk with a walker. You cannot walk without a walker. So, however that conversation went, she seems not to have resented it at all. She seems to love the son. Seems to have all gone fine between them. But the question is, let's suppose a parent is walking without a walker, and the child knows medically they need the walker to walk, because if they walk without the walker, there's a likelihood they'll fall, and if they fall, they might, you know, break a bone or break a hip, and that could this and this and this. So it's for their own good. That's a, it's an example that maybe is better for people listening, because it doesn't carry this stigma, and I'm not saying it's a wrong stigma, but it doesn't carry the stigma of you're locking your parent in a wheelchair. The question is, what could the child do? So the reason why I brought it up was because that example is, well, they'll either walk with a walker or not. But let's suppose you say, well, if you can't walk with a walker, you'll sit in a wheelchair. And they say, okay, I'll sit in a wheelchair. But their balance is so bad that to sit in a wheelchair, they also need to be strapped in. They need to be seatbelted. And the parent says, I don't want to be seatbelted. And the child says, tough luck, I'm seatbelting you. That's maybe another a good parallel example of this. How can you, or can you, for the benefit of the parent, strap them into a wheelchair against their will? Now, the Gemara in Kiddushin, so this is, now we're getting back to the answer to the Tzitzit Ezra gift. Gemara in Kiddushin, Alamed Aleph Amid Bet, tells the story about Rav Asi. Rav Asi had a mother who was elderly, and she says to him, now we're going to learn the Gemara the way it reads in the Gemara, and then we'll have to figure out, the Tzitzit Ezra will have to figure out what the ramifications of this are. So the Gemara itself says, Rav Asi, the mother is aged, and she says to him, I want to get married again. First she says, I want the kind of things like decorations, it might mean spices, it might mean jewelry, that would lead people to be, a man, to be interested in marrying me. He gets that for her. And then she says, I want a man. And he starts looking around for a man who would marry her and who would be a good match for her. And then she says, no, I want a man who's as good as you, which probably means something like who's as young as you and as successful as you and things like that. But she is, you know, at least 15, 20 years older than him. So he realizes that he... So what he realized is not clear in the Gemara. The Gemara just says he was Azil Shavka, he left her alone, the Azil Arad Yisrael, and went to Israel. So the Gemara quotes that as a reasonable option on his. Now, in the Tilsit Rehazakein, they explain that he recognized that she had gone crazy. Sorry, that might not be the best way to say it. Nitrif, the Gemara's term is nitrifadata, that her senses had been destroyed, let's say, or lost. So maybe that's a better way to express ourselves, that she had lost her senses, she wasn't in her right mind, and therefore he ran away because he knew that there was no way that he could fulfill what she wanted and do what's expected of him in terms of kibud av va'im. Meaning, for the Tosafot Rehazakein, there's a realization here that he can't help her, and there's a feeling that he's supposed to be trying to help her. So he figures he has to go away. He has to leave. And that would teach, if we follow the opinion of the Rehazakein, that would teach that anybody who recognizes that a parent has lost their mind, is not in their right mind, to such an extent that they can't help them, he's only got a choice of leaving, meaning they want things from me that I can't do, and the only way I could handle them and deal with them would be if I mistreated them in a way that is against halacha, then I'm not allowed to. And that's how, says the Tzitzit, that's how the Rambam paskins it as well. In the sixth chapter of Hilchos Mamrim Halacha Yud, which is a reminder that the Rambam places the laws of Kibud Av Va'Em in Hilchos Mamrim. Mamrim is usually about people who rebel against authorities that they're not to rebel against, and parents are among that. So he paskins there that if somebody whose parent lost their senses, Mishi Trifad Da'ato Da'at Aviv Va'Emo, he's mishtadel linhog imam kefi da'atam achi ruchamalem. The first step is you try to deal with them, you try to stick with them and help them out, and in the hope that they'll come back to their right mind. And if it's impossible for you to stick with them and to help them out and to deal with them in an appropriate way, the Rambam writes, then the Rambam says, Yani chevyelech, though he's got to leave them, but he adds, this will be an important clause, b'yitzaveh acherim lanhigam karaui lahem. And he should command others to treat them. Now the phrase in our written Gemara, in our written Rambam is, karaui lahem, as is appropriate to them. So that sounds like he means, make arrangements for them to be taken care of, but he himself can leave. The Rabbi there disagrees, and he questions this psak of the Rambam. He says, it's not correct. If he goes, who's in a command to watch them? The question is, what does the Rabbi mean? Meaning the Rambam sounds like you hire people, and they watch them for them. So the Tzur in Yeridea quotes both, and the Beis Yosef there says that the Rambam seems to assume the Rambam is the way we paskin, the way we rule. But the Bach says that he feels, agrees with the Ravid, and he says the point of the Ravid is that it's not similar to the case of Rav Asi, because in Rav Asi, it wasn't that she went crazy, that she had lost her mind, and she wasn't in her right mind. It was that she was old. And therefore, she had asked for something impossible, but not in a way that, in fact, says she's lost her senses. She just wanted something that's beyond it. Meaning, there are all sorts of people today, especially in the context of marriage, who are looking and look for a long period of time for that which is out of their reach in whatever way. You know, imagine somebody who's living in an ordinary society, a middle-class society, and decides they're going to marry a billionaire. So there are some people for whom that might be true, men or women, whom that there might be some feasible way they can do that. But Rav Asi's mother was looking for something that was just beyond her reach. He didn't know how to handle it, how to deal with that. He couldn't say just no to her, or there's no way you could do it. And therefore, he left because he was worried that he wouldn't fulfill her wishes. Now, I think it's an interesting thing that the Bach is assuming, therefore, that when a parent asks something of you, you're supposed to do it. And if you can't do it, that fleeing to Eretz Yisrael might be the only option you have. That would be what the Bach assumes. I don't think we paskin this way, but that's what the Bach seems to assume. But says the Bach, if in fact, but the Bach says that the parent had really lost their mind, right? That wasn't the issue. It wasn't the issue of they asked for things that were beyond what they really could get were feasible. They really lost their mind, so there, and they need special watching. He says it doesn't make any sense that you should be allowed to leave them, meaning when Rav Asi leaves his mother in the Bach's reading of it, when Rav Asi leaves his mother, she can basically take care of herself. She just can't find a husband. Since she can't find the husband, so he can't fulfill that wish for her, so he leaves her, but she's going to be fine. But if she's really out of her right mind, such that she can't take care of herself, so the Bach says, how could he leave her? And that's what he thinks the Ravid is saying. It doesn't make sense, because first of all, he's no longer required to try to fulfill her wishes because she's lost her mind. So when she lost her mind, her requests are no longer ones that you have to worry about. And therefore, there's no punishment if he doesn't fulfill all her requests, so he should stay and take care of her. All he has to do is feed her and give her drink and make sure that she isn't, you know, she doesn't get into trouble and she doesn't damage herself. So how can he leave for that? That's the way the Bach reads it. Now, the Sicilius is going to get there soon about what the response to that could be, what the Rambam's response to that would have been. But he just wants to point that the Drisha also agrees with the Ravid. But the Drisha, which is another commentary on the tour, like the Bach is, the Drisha understood the Ravid to mean that since the Rambam wrote, you should command other people, it sounds like other people will be able to take care of her. So if other people can take care of her, then, says the Drisha, all the more so that this person can do it. Meaning, this person knows, let's say Rav Asi, or people like Rav Asi, they know their parents better than other people know their parents. So the idea, now this, again, is a place where our current thinking might contrast with this, and I'll get to it in a second, but I'm just trying to report what the Drisha says. The Drisha says that since the child knows the parent better, they'll be able to do it better. In the case of the Gemara, it doesn't mention that he commanded anybody else to do it, so it could be, says the Drisha, that she was already so far gone that nobody would be able to take care of her, and that's how the Taz seems to have taken it as well. So that's the representation of their view. Now, today I might easily say that it's an odd position of the Drishas, because when you have people who have lost their senses, so sometimes nobody really knows how to take care of them, or everybody knows how to take care of them. Part of taking care of them is you have to either ignore things that they say, or gently or not so gently force them to do things that you don't want. Let's say sometimes you might have to force feed them, for all I know, to a certain extent, or all sorts of things that might be out of the bounds of halacha. Whether or not those are true, that would be a question for medicine today, and I'm not a person who's an expert on how to deal with geriatrics or people with Alzheimer's and things like that, and it could be that today we found ways to do all of those kinds of things in gentle rather than problematic ways. But in their discussion, there seems to be an assumption that, for the Drisha for sure, that the kid will know better how to do it. But I think sometimes when somebody comes to it without the baggage of whatever goes on in raising kids and in children and parents interacting and all those years, they come to it without that, that sometimes it's not true. Sometimes they're even, they find it easier to deal with that person just as that person is right now, and just gently and they can get them to do things that, for whatever reasons and however the workings of the minds of those who are unfortunately losing their minds works, that there are things in there that when a child tries to do it might be problematic, when somebody else tries to do it might not be. So I think that there's a lot of factual issues here that you could argue with. So the Bach and the Ravid and the Drisha and seemingly the Taz are on the side that thinks that if somebody else could do it, then you certainly could do it. And if there's something to be done, then you should be the one to be doing it, because why should you hire somebody else? And if you can't do it, then it must mean that nobody else can do it. That's a factual question that I'm not sure. That's the way that they're understanding it. I'm not sure about that factual question. I'm not positive that's what the Ravid meant, just because the Ravid doesn't say it quite so clearly. But then, if that's not the factual issue that we're discussing here, that'll be a problem. So the Tzitzit Lishah goes on to say, it's kind of surprising. When the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch report the Rambam's view, they report it as, Karaoi, and they left out the word lahem, right? We have in our Rambams, we have the words karaoi lahem as appropriate to them, to each particular parent in each particular situation, whereas the Torah Shulchan Aruch just quoted as karaoi, as is appropriate. And that sounds like, it would just mean as whatever the standards of appropriateness are. And the Tzitzit says, Lefi aniyat ta'ati, dafka shidui zehu hakoveh b'kavan haram. That's a crucial word, because the point of the Rambam, and that if you leave out that word, you then understand the Ravid a lot better, because if you put in the word lahem, then the whole hasaga of the Ravid goes away. And he thinks that, and the Tzitzit says in the Radvah seems the same thing, that it dehu lo matze ligor, he will not be able to get angry with a parent, for example, whereas others, or to rebuke a parent or to discipline a parent, whereas others can do that, and it could be by, and the Tzitzit Ezra is willing to assume, and again, I'm not saying this is correct, I'm just pointing out that this raises your cubit of aim, they're not willing to assume, he's willing to assume that sometimes hitting the parent would be okay. So we don't have the same views of discipline today and of how to help people realize what they need to do. But the point is, Tzitzit Ezra is willing to entertain the possibility that sometimes, let's say, a slap to the face might allow or help heal this parent from whatever's going on with them. You know, let's say they're in the middle of an episode of some sort, and you see this in the movies. I'm not saying it's recommended, but, you know, if you slap them once, they break out of it. So let's suppose for a second that that was true, and that is in fact the way to handle these kinds of situations. So then the Rambam makes sense. The Rambam says, "Karaoi lahem," as appropriate to them. And he says, "Masi b'chol yom," that we have cases like this all the time, and the child can't do it. That's the key point. A child can't do that to a parent, even if it's what the parent needs. So even let's suppose it were true that somebody was in a situation of, they were in some kind of a delirium or a seizure or whatever it was, and the way to get them out is a slap across the face. Child can't do it. The Aruch HaShulchan Yerodea, Simon Reish Mem, also says that. He says, Yodua Shamishtakim Bioter Bechriach Losram. Again, this is late 19th, early 20th century medicine, so we might not do this anymore, but there are people who need to be restrained. That's probably a better way to do it. You know, people need to be in a straitjacket, because otherwise they'll damage or hurt themselves. So that, I think we still might do today, unless we might medicate them today, but even medicating them might be a problem in terms of if you forcibly medicate them, you hold them down to be able to medicate them. So all those kinds of things, the Aruch HaShulchan says, so to restrain somebody like that, a child's not allowed to do it. And therefore the child, that's what the Rambam was saying, the child can command or order or ask or pay somebody else to do it. So he says, if once you read it that way, meaning if the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch had a different gear to the Rambam, they had seen a misquote of the Rambam, or for whatever it was, they left out that word, Ra'oi lahem was left out, then karaoi just mean a general standard of what's appropriate. So a general standard of what's appropriate, why shouldn't the kid do it, the child do it, do any more than anybody else should do it? But the Tzitzit Ezra is saying, he thinks he was pointing the Rambam's point was, there are occasions where what's appropriate to a person is sometimes, to deal with a person, to deal with person's health, is sometimes unacceptable for a child to do it. So he's going to give us other examples that don't get into these sensitive issues in a second. So mistabrit v'chaygav negam achokim yodu. That if that's true, that you have to restrain a person, you have to slap a person, that kind of force you can't use. You can't use on a parent even if it's for their own good, and you have to let somebody else do it. And it's only because the Rambam didn't make clear that that's what he meant, and that's why they came to disagree. Because he says it's hard to imagine that if with the necessary dealing with a parent involves that kind of force, but it's for their own good, that you would in fact think, that anybody would in fact think, it's hard to imagine the rival would in fact think, that if the child's going to have somebody else do it, he might as well do it himself. himself because it's not true. Because, and these are the examples that are worth paying attention to, Daha, even if your father or mother, God forbid, if someone's father and mother are evildoers, they've left, they knew about what Judaism wants of them, they've chosen not to keep it, they don't keep anything, they worship idols, whatever it is they may do. And even if a court has decided, you know, in the times when we had courts that would decide these things, that they deserve capital punishment for, let's say, they violated Shabbos in public, and they got warning from two witnesses, and they said, I don't care, I'm doing it anyway, and they did it right then, and they brought them to court, and the court, even though courts only are supposed to kill people once in 7 years, they decided, yep, this is the once in 7 years time and opportunity to that we have to, unfortunately, put this person to death. That person's child is not allowed to do so. And that's how the Rambam paskens it. Not only that, so you could say, well, that's punitive. So that's not for the parents' own good. We could argue about whether it's for the parents' own good or not, but you could say that's punitive, and that's why they can't do it. But let's say there was a situation where harming them physically would be for their own good. So in fact, the halacha is, remember that in the time of the Gemara, bloodletting was assumed to be medically beneficial. So let's assume that a parent needs to have bloodlet by their standards of medicine. So it's important to know when you're talking about these questions, if you think bloodletting is a medical necessity, for your standards, it's a medical necessity. So we don't think it anymore necessarily, but let's say you thought it was. So what do you do? Can you let the parents' blood? It's for their own benefit. An example that still does work today is, let's suppose a parent needs to have a limb amputated, right? Sadly, let's say a parent, you know, got gangrene in their three toes, and they're going to amputate three toes, and the doctor and a son or a daughter is a doctor, very qualified, you know, best in the business in amputating the toes. As long as there's somebody else who's competent enough to do the job right and well, the child's not supposed to do it. So that is the firm demonstration of what the tzaddikim are talking about, how he's understanding the Rambam, and how it reflects on this question, right? That even if something is for the benefit of a parent, if it involves physical violence, again, it's not negative violence, but it's physical hurting of the parent, child's not allowed to do it, and therefore the Rambam wrote, "Kara oy lahem." You have to hire people to do what's necessary for them, especially if it's things that the child can't do, is not allowed halachically to do. And therefore he says, "Lidati barur pashut." It's clear to me in that narrow case that the child in fact cannot tie up a mother to a chair. What he has to do is he has to give her over to somebody to set her up with a situation where she will be lovingly taken care of. And if part of loving care is in that time, as far as anybody knew in that time, was to tie her up in a chair, then that's what they would do. But the point is not to tie her up in the chair; it's the standard. If the care of a parent will necessarily involve things that are prohibited for a child to do, then the child has to hire somebody else to do it and not do it themselves. That's the end of the tshuva. But then the Tzitzit Ezra does, is he does more often than anybody else I've seen, he writes Bishulei HaTshuva, a postscript. So there's two parts of the script. I'm skipping one of them because it was a different topic that wasn't our issue. But then he points out that Rabbi Akiva Eger has a tshuva in Siman Samachet, where he talks about what he thinks of as a steer, as a contradiction in terms of kibud av va'em after the passing of a parent, after the death of a parent. So the Gemara Kiddushin Lamed Aleph says you have to honor your parent, in this case the father, while the father is alive, and after the father passes on. Whereas in Ketubot Daf Kuf Gimel, you have another Gemara that says that one is not obligated to honor their older brother after the passing of the father, even though. And here's the key thing. Even though we have a Gemara, the Gemara is very clear that kibud eshet aviv, honoring a father's wife or an older brother, is actually an extension of the obligation to honor a father, to honor a parent. As the Ramban writes, that it's a gnai to the father, to the parent, to dishonor their toldo, their descendants or their spouses. So it sounds like that you're not, so if we say that you don't have to honor your older brother after the father has passed away, it sounds like that means that you're not obligated in the honor of the father after the father has passed away. So how do you put those two together? So that Rabbi Akiva Eger suggested that there's a difference between honor to the father directly, such as saying, for example, after the father passed away, saying, my father, my teacher, Abba Mari, and that continues the honor of the father, and that applies even after passing away. But in terms of the other people, Rabbi Akiva Eger suggests that the honor that was given to them was only, in their lifetime, was only so that the father would get pleasure out of it. It would mean that the father knows that the son is treating his wife well or treating his older brother well. The father is happy about it, and therefore it's sort of like you feed a father, you right? That's a part of the obligation to keep it avayim. You have to feed a father, you have to help the father drink. So too, you have to help the father not have pain and suffering. That's an interesting extension that Rabbi Baker takes for granted, that it's an obligation of a child, without, if there are no other factors involved, to try to avoid giving grief to a parent. And part of that is honoring the wife and honoring the older siblings. And therefore, that's where Rabbi Akiva has it. But when the father's no longer around, there's no more nachat ruach, right? If the father doesn't know that it's going on, it won't bother the father. That was his suggestion. His suggestion was that the honor you give to a father's wife and to an older sibling is only to keep the parent happy. So if the parent's no longer around, you don't have to worry about it anymore. And it's not a function of there not being a requirement of kibbut avayim anymore. It's that form of kibbut avayim doesn't exist anymore, right? Nobody would claim you have to feed your parent after they passed away, because they passed away. So too, nobody, you're saying, nobody would claim you have to do the honor to other people that you did in order to help the parent be happier after the parent passed away. That's his suggestion. Whereas, what the Gemara says, there is an obligation to kibbut avayim of honoring a parent after the parent has passed away. That's in terms of when you mention the parent, you say things like, Abba Mari, my father, my teacher, and you demonstrate the respect that you still carry for the person who passed away. So Tertullius is not thrilled with this answer of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He says, because if you look in the Gemara in Ketubot, it's only about the father's wife that it's clear you're not obligated in their honor after the father has passed away, but not about the brother, right? And that's what Rashi stresses as well. When the Gemara says, Rashi says, it seems like it's only the father's wife that's only during the father's lifetime. And Tisadosa says, there's a big difference between them. Why? Because the father's wife, after the father passes away, we're not talking about the person's mother here, we're talking about a second wife, you know, a different wife. Once the father has passed away, then this woman is basically nothing to the children, right? She's their father's ex-wife, right? If they got divorced, she'd be nothing to them. When the father passes away, also, death separates a marriage, it ends a marriage. So this woman now is nothing to them. So therefore, there's no lingering or continuing obligation to honor this woman in particular. It's not that you're allowed to mistreat her, but there's an obligation to honor her because she's not anything to you. She's an arayah to you. You can't marry her ever, right? But other than that, there's no obligation to, but an older brother. So the older brother is still the son of your father and your older brother, and that's true after passing. So therefore, Rabbi Tzitzilis says, I would think that the obligation of kibbut continues just like it did before. Because when it comes to kibbut avayim, the answer is that actually when they after they pass away, you're still fully obligated in kibbut avayim, in honoring them, and that includes honoring the relatives you have that extend from them. So that puts the two Gemaras together in a way that fits perfectly. And he says, I saw that the Minchas Chinuch says the same thing, that when it comes to eshet aviv, when it comes to a father's wife or a mother's husband, that you're not obligated and they're covered once they pass away because they're no longer a father's wife or a mother's husband. But an older brother, that continues even after the passing of the parent for the reasons that we just said. And then he points out that Pirkei Teshuvah in Yerodea has a Shut Knesset Yecheskel, who claims there's actually a machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban in their discussions of the Sefer HaMitzvot, is whether it's purely an issue of kibbut avayim, and then maybe when they passed away, you don't have to do it anymore, or it's an extension, it's a thing of its own, that because of their relationship to the father or the mother, you have to continue honoring them even after they're passing. And the Cheskel says, and I don't understand why Rabbi Akiva Eger didn't recognize this. So for the 11th of Iyar, we have some of the issues that come with kibbut avayim. We have the fact that we are not allowed to act violently towards a parent, even if that violence, even that physical damage, is actually for their own good in various ways. Strapping them into a wheelchair if they have a balance problem would be a relatively innocuous example. Amputating a limb if they need to have that limb amputated would be a good example, right? In those situations, the child is nonetheless not allowed to do it, and that therefore there are situations, including where parents have unfortunately lost their senses, where we might follow the Rambam's perspective that if one is not able to treat the parent halachically as they require to, by virtue of the parent's problems, especially their loss of their senses, that we would then have to give them over to other people to take care of and let them do it, because for them it's not a violation since they're doing it on behalf of the person in order to take care of them well. And that is a responsibility for the 11th of Iyar. with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Abramowitz, and to David Achazer for their help with this year online. I wish you a great day.